As I was about ready to leave the house, two of my sons were sitting on the couch with a neighbor kid, and Dan never knows what's going on, even if he's sitting there hearing it all. And he said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm going out to Glen Eyrie to preach to a bunch of people on how to raise kids." And the neighbor kid says, "You mean to think, what license is you for this? Five mistakes?" You know? So anyway, I don't get any respect, so it's good to have you here to give me some. Seriously, every time I'm asked to speak on this subject, I really feel uncomfortable starting. Because I think there's a couple reasons for that. One, I have had friends and associates and people that I've known who are Christian leaders, whom I respected spiritually, and they've had the horrible experience, I guess you'd have to call it, of having a child reach teenage of some kind and just go like that. And I have tried to figure out what was wrong with their life if that happened, and I can't figure it out. They examine themselves and try to figure it out. They can't figure it out. And I think, let's see, maybe nobody really knows how you work this thing out. And the thing that I have found also is that the people who speak with the greatest authority on this subject are not people like myself. I hope that we know better. The people who usually speak with the greatest authority are the people who don't have any kids. You know, the best candidates are ex-youth directors that are single, nuns, 25-year-old PhDs in child psychology who are single. Man, they can tell us all we need to know and more. Then I found there's another class of parent, though, that's an expert, and that's the one who has children under four. They have managed to get them through the terrible twos, and they think that they did something very outstanding in the way of discipline or something to get them through that. And here's this sweet little 3.5-year-old that's just so innocent and so fun and so pleasant, and they think they really have gotten there. And I've heard them preach on how to discipline kids, and I tell you, you can't learn any more than they know. Now, the problem is when you get to where I am, you wonder, did I do anything right, or what is it I did? You know? And was it right or was it wrong? And was it right with this one and wrong with that one? So it's an interesting problem to have the worst experts you could have standing before you. My dad told me, though, when I was discussing this with him last year, he said, "You know what? I'm the guy that has the answers, but nobody ever asked me." And that's right, at 75 you ought to know a thing or two, after watching kids and whatever, kind of get there. I would like to begin. I'm not going to give you an awful lot of Bible. One reason is there isn't a lot of Bible on this subject. Have you ever noticed that? Have you ever done a Bible study on raising kids and found the 6 verses you've got to look with? That's it, or so. But I would like to just kind of lay a foundation by saying this. What's the importance of this subject to us as Christians? Well, first of all, in Genesis chapter 2, God sets up the family. And he talks about marriage. And he says, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they two shall be one flesh." Now, what that says to me is that God intended for the family to be the basic unit of society. You notice the man leaves his father and mother, that last family unit, cleaves to his wife, they become one flesh. They become a new family unit. That's the unit of society that God established. Now, we have managed in this country to make a shambles out of that. I think it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate because of the effect it had. And the most unfortunate part is that we Christians sometimes are joining the world around us in destroying the family. We see Christians who seem to think that divorce is the answer. I don't think that is the answer. And I think we need to take a serious look at the effects. I was we were on a little family jaunt back to the Midwest where my nephew was getting married, and we decided to take a trip through South Dakota and hit the Badlands and Black Hills on the way back. We were in Rapid City, and I picked up a Denver Post. And while we were sitting there eating breakfast or waiting for breakfast to arrive, I read this little article. There was some educators who had done a survey on the effects of one-parent families on children. Now, I wish that I had cut that article out and brought it here and been able to read the exact figures, because I forget quickly. But they found that by far the largest percentage of low achievers in school are from one-parent families. And by far the majority of the kids who get kicked out of school are from one-parent families. And the worst part of that picture is that the statement was made at the bottom that of all the children living in this country today, 45% of them will live at least 1 year of their life in a one-parent family. It's getting off close to half. So the family is not being treated like God intended for it to be treated. So I think it's a serious matter to us. I think that if we aspire to be Christian leaders, it's even more serious. In 1 Timothy, Paul gave some description here of qualifications for Christian leadership. And for a bishop, he says this: he must manage his own household well, keeping his children submissive and respectful in every way. For if a man does not know how to manage his own household, how can he care for the church of God? Now, I know that Christian leaders have problems with their families. I alluded to that at the very beginning. But maybe it's because we get too concerned about being Christian leaders and not concerned enough about God's priority system. The real priority that God has for us is to make sure that our family's squared away, then we can worry about the ministry. I have a friend who presents priorities in life, and talks about that sort of thing. I think we all go through these things, and you usually see something like this in the way of a priority system. Well, God is the first priority, and the second priority would be the family, and the third priority for most people who are in business is business, and then down here they usually put ministry. This fellow has been very successful in business and was sharing this, and he said that the thing that frustrated him a great deal about this priority system is that he could never quite get the balance between business and ministry. You let the business go to pot, and then that isn't doing what it ought to do, and then you're off running all over the country doing ministry. And then you got to come back and say, hey, wait a minute. And then you give all your time to business and there's not enough ministry. He said, I came to a conclusion. Hey, my business is my ministry. Now, that's an excellent conclusion. I just heard a survey recently, which was a survey of Christians, how they became Christians. What brought you in? Things like, did you walk into a church and hear a message and get saved? 2% like that. Something like the big media things, like we have big evangelistic crusades, we've got radio, television, all that sort of thing. They account for about 0.003% of the people who become Christians. By far the mass majority, 80% I think it comes out, are people who have become Christians as a right result of contact personally with either a family member or a friend or associate. Now that tells me something to expand on this man's priority system. Your business is your ministry, but so is your family. If 80% of the people who become Christians because of family or association with you, with somebody else, then our family is very important to us from a standpoint of priority. And maybe we ought to forget about ministry entirely and making that some kind of a thing we do. And we ought to make our ministry where we live, in the house, and where we work. That's where we have real contact with people anyway. Now, I'd like to just philosophize with you a little bit about phases of... do we have a wet something or other here to erase just in case I get carried away? Yep, no, that's dry. Somebody want to wet that? If you will, please. I'm going to take you through a little bit of a development here of how I see children you know, certain phases of child growth and development, I'm probably not going to give you the thing you're going to read anywhere else. The first, I call these three phases. Well, that pen's getting tired too, isn't it? We may have to retire. Here we go. The first phase, I'm going to run from 0 to 4, phase 1. And then we'll have a phase 2. I'm going to make this one a long one. That's going to go to age of, well, it's kind of a variation here, say 12 to 14, wherever puberty happens to strike somebody. And out here, the last phase will go to, let's just say 21. Now, the reason I pick 4 as a phase is up to age 4, you're dealing with a certain kind of a person that's different than you're going to deal with the rest of their life. Now, it changes, it might be 3, but, you know, it's somewhere in that neighborhood. Now, the reason I choose that is I've done a little survey. I've asked myself some questions. I've asked my kids questions that are old enough to answer those questions. I've asked groups of adults the same kind of a question. I ask them, when do you really remember something? The first memory you have that you can recall, what was it? And for me, I can remember living in a house in West Des Moines, Iowa. There was an apple tree next door to it, and we used to play around that thing. And it was just before I went to school, about age 4. And I've asked others, what's the first recollection? And they come up with about that same answer. So there's something happens in there at about age 4 where you start cataloging stuff that you're going to remember. From that, up till that point, you're just kind of there, I guess. Now, I'm sure that a lot of things are being developed, words, you know, and all that sort of thing. But there's really innocence there. I love kids that are 3.5, 4 years old. I could talk to them all day long. I can sit there and laugh and enjoy them because they are so innocent. They don't know they're funny. And they'll say things just as serious as can be, and you just die laughing, and they don't know what you're laughing at. Now, about the time they get to be 5, they start figuring out that whatever they said was funny, or whatever they did was funny, and then they try to repeat it to get the laughs again. Now they aren't funny anymore. So there's a certain self-consciousness comes in at about age 4. Now I call that phase the pain and pleasure area. I didn't have enough room. Pain and pleasure. This is the way you deal with that kind of child. We might, just to give you some other alternatives, I'll call this the Marine Corps, USMC part. By the way, I heard something the other day about the Marines. That's why I put it in there. This guy said, did you know that most Marines will be in heaven? Now, the first reaction to that is not so fast. You know, we all know their reputation. Well, the reason is because most of them never reach the age of accountability. Well, anyway. So this is that phase of their life. I heard another guy say this is Uncle Sam's misguided children. But anyway, there's another way to describe this, and this is the dog training years. I know you don't like that, especially if you have one of this age. But when Kay took our dog to doggy school and came back with all the philosophy and everything, I realized there's a great correlation between training a dog and training a child that's between 0 and 4. Because the way they respond is to pain and pleasure. See, if you want to train a dog to heel, you say heel with a leash on them. And if you want them right there, if they get too far back, you grab the leash and go whoop. And they go, you know, and then they figure out that that was not too comfortable. And after a couple of trips, they find out, hey, maybe I shouldn't walk that far behind this guy. Then pretty soon they get a little anxious to get ahead of you, so they're walking up here. The way you solve that is you take a quick left and kick them in the head, you know. Then they say, that wasn't so comfortable. Well, pretty soon they figure out that the pleasant place to be is between here and here. Not ahead of that or not behind it. You establish the limits for the dog just merely by executing a little bit of pain. Now, if you're training a pup to try to retrieve something, you wait until they accidentally do it and then give them something they really like. Then you do it again. And pretty soon they think, hey, I got this figured out. Run and get the bag. He gives me a goodie. Now, I don't think they reasoned it out quite that clearly. But this is the phase that I think a child is in when they are up, getting up to about four. You don't reason with a two-year-old. If you do, I'd like to sit and listen with how you do it. We have one of those. I have never managed that yet. I haven't managed a lot of things yet with her. Well, let's get on to that next phase. If I can find the right notes here. Okay, this one we'll call the reason and communication phase. In fact, I'd like to add to it here, we're going to impart a number of things to them. Let's start with wisdom. Hopefully we have a little bit of that. Values and those kinds of things. Knowledge. Now, this isn't going to happen instantaneously. I think you can plainly see this. We're going to get into this from the pain and pleasure thing. All of a sudden, someday we're going to reach a point where we can actually reason with this individual about what they're doing and why they're doing it and why that's acceptable and why it isn't. Then we can get away from the pain and pleasure thing and we can start a reasoning process going. Now, I'm going to move on quickly to the third phase here and then we'll get back. At about age 12 to 13, when puberty sets in, we have a very definite drive for independence. Now, you can like it or not, you're going to have that. How many of you have teenagers, by the way? Have you encountered that? Yes. They want to be independent, and they're going to be. As a matter of fact, this is an irreversible process. In fact, I think maybe this last little bundle of joy we have is teaching me a great deal about children. You know, I've had a chance to kind of get that cloud of four bit by me and see, and didn't quite get all the details that first trip. But you know, this time around, one of the things that I've noticed about Lisa is it's like she's you've heard this thing about a fat person is a skinny person trying to get out. You've heard that? Well, there's something like that in kids. That a child is just a little bundle with a human being in there trying to get out. And there's a force going that you just can't stop. They want to talk. When they can't get that done, they yell at you. Because they can't quite communicate what they want and you can't understand it, so the only thing left is, you know, something else. When they walk, they get up, fall down, get up, fall down, get up, fall down, but they're going to do it. When they run, you start running after them. But anyway, we have this little dynamo going. In fact, it's kind of funny. The older kids, their reaction to Lisa. The other day, Lisa was sitting on the bottom step that goes up to the upper level, and she's sitting there with her legs crossed, you know, looking very ladylike. And Dan says, "She's a real human." And I said, "Well, how about that, Lisa? He just welcomed you into the human race." This is the term they seem to be. I get a kick out of it every time. That's right. They're real human, and they're going to get out of there, and they're going someplace. Well, I think the thing we have to realize is where they're going and kind of go along with them. When we get to this point, they're going to be independent whether you like it or not. And that's the point we need to be prepared for. And we're going to talk a little more in detail about that. So this phase out here, when they start reaching that point of independence, I'm going to call that phase release with communication. I hope that we still have that. I think this is the ideal. This is what we're aiming at least. We would like to be able to release them and still stay in touch with them, be able to talk about what's going on and why. Unfortunately, this is where most of us fail in if there's any failure in the teenage area, this is probably it. They get to the place they want to be independent. We haven't quite prepared ourselves to let them be that way. So as a consequence, we quit communicating. We have no relationship with them whatsoever. They come and go, eat at the table, sleep in the bed, and whatever it is, but you don't talk to them anymore. I think this phase really ought to be a release with communication. Now, I'm going to have to add something in here, and that is that there's a big chunk of trust that you have to develop when you get to that point. My son taught me this, the oldest one. It was kind of a series of events that taught me this. We had an old beat-up Chevy truck that he used to drive, and I didn't pay any attention to what time he came in at night, because I really wasn't into that. It didn't bother me, I guess. But one morning, I got a call at about 1:30 from a mother who was more concerned than I was, obviously. And he had been out with her son, and she says, "Is David home?" I said, "I don't know. Let me go see if the truck's here." So I went out and looked. No truck. Came back to the phone. I said, "I don't think he is." "Well, do you know where he is?" I said, "No, I really don't." Well, she was obviously concerned, and about this, she generated a little concern in me. Now, let's see, 1:30 at night, I don't know where he is. He could be on the Rampart Range Road with a truck rolled over on top of him. I don't know where he is. So I waited for him to arrive. We had a little discussion, one-way communication. I said to him, "Hey, I don't know where you are. I don't like this being out this late in the morning or whatever you want to call this thing. So from now on, you're getting in here. Midnight's the end." Okay, fine. Well, he really shaped up. I mean, it wasn't midnight. He was in there at 10, 10:30. You know, it really looked good for a while. And it went on for quite a while. And then one evening, I watched a movie, a late movie on TV till about 12:30, and he wasn't in yet. Well, the more I thought about the 12 o'clock and the fact that he wasn't in, and all the more irritated I got. So I waited. You know, he got in about 15 minutes later, but I was sitting there waiting for him. Well, now I'd already told him what I thought about this program before, so now I was really ready to, you know, jump all over his frame. So I proceeded to, you know, give him some more one-way instruction, but I said this time, "You got anything to say for yourself?" And he started to kind of say something, then he turned around and, "Yeah, I guess I do." So he started to tell me his side of the story. He said, "Well, I'll tell you what I was doing tonight. We were at this high school dance, and the people who have to clean up afterwards are very small in number, and you know they're going to be there extremely late if somebody doesn't help them, and I decided that the right thing to do was help them." I thought, "Yeah, that's probably right. It's probably what I would have done." Then he went on to explain to me, which is very interesting, how I had a different background than he had. Which was kind of humorous. You know, you're laughing about it, so was I inside, but, you know. Now, let's see, how much different? But anyway, it's true. We're a little looser now than we used to be, than it was when I was going his age. So I let him finish that, and then he said, "This is the devastating thing." He said, "You don't really trust me." I said, "Yep, I don't. But I learned to. Because I realized the decision he made is exactly the one I would have made, and I was proud of him for doing it. And I have trusted him ever since. I don't ask him why he got in late. Because I know that if he had a reason for doing it, he was late. And if he was late, he had a reason for doing it. And I think right here is where the ball game's played later on. You've got to trust them. Now, let's talk a little bit about how we get to that place and why. I want to talk about, let's see, boy, whatever happened to that wet towel here? Underwear? Okay. We'll get it when we need it. There's several things that I want to talk about. One of them is the subject of self-image. It seems to be very important these days. I suppose it was always important, but we hear a lot about it today. In fact, we have a neighbor who is taking care of their grandchild now, whose parents are divorced. Mother couldn't handle what was going on, so dumped him off at grandma's place. Dottie has a very negative self-image, very low esteem. And it's pretty obvious to everybody that sees her. I think, how'd she get that way? Well, one of the things that we're doing as we raise children is we are developing their self-image. Their image of themselves is what we convey to them. I'm convinced of that. And if we're going to be, you know, the hard-nosed disciplinarian beating on their heads all day long and all night long for years and years and years, guess what? What kind of an image are they going to have? I can never do anything right. Isn't that kind of the picture they're going to get on a lot of their life? I came to observe this with Lisa. Lisa probably would be described by many people as a spoiled brat. I hope she's not, and I hope she isn't when it all ends up down in the wash. But one of the things I've observed about her is when she walks in a room, she really believes she's the most important person there. There is absolutely no doubt in her mind that she is the center of the action. Now, she doesn't know any better, but she still believes it. Now, if we want to develop a good self-image, we better never kill that. I think for starters, when they're very, very small, we need to give them attention. Now, I've never been into psychology a whole lot, and a lot of stuff that people tell me that psychologists say I don't buy, but I'm going to convey this anyway because I think there's some logic to it. And that is that when an infant is an infant, you know, a small blob in the you know, that you just pick up and they're like jelly, they still need something from you as a parent, and that is they need to be held and fondled. Now, all I can figure out is that's the only way we can give them attention and let them know that somebody cares. I don't know what else that means. And as they continue to mature, slow as it is, we have to keep doing that. For instance, Lisa is able to say a new word. Ah, we go bananas. Hey, listen to this. Whoopee-doo. Okay, why? We make that very important. She gets to the place where she can put a star-shaped object in a star-shaped hole, and that's a big event. Now, I think it's easy when they're little to do that because there's so much, you know, so much going on, exciting and everything. And then pretty soon they get a little older and, you know, kind of lose interest in that. We were running a navigator home in Minneapolis, working with the navigators, and had three or four guys living with us. And we had Linda was probably in the second or third grade. David was about four. Dan, I suppose, was one. And Doug didn't exist, neither did Lisa. And I came home from a trip. I think I'd made this trip to go survey the possibilities of opening up some other campus work and everything. So I got back to Minneapolis, and you know what? We sat down at a meal, and that was about the first contact with the whole family, anybody. And something happened. And that is that the guy started asking me questions about what did you think in Fargo when you were there. You know, tell us more about this, that, and the other thing. They were just full of questions about my trip. Now, from an adult standpoint, I'd much rather talk about that because that's the thing I was really interested in. That's what I'd just done. And, you know, that was the level that I was pretty excited about. And I think Kay was also on that level. But over here next to me was David pulling on my leg. Say, hey, we caught a rattlesnake, garter snake out in the backyard where you were going. Beat him to death with a broom. Well, I wasn't really interested in beating a snake to death with a broom. I was more interested in this other thing. But I realized something, and I'm glad I realized it, that the important thing to him, he couldn't care less about whether Fargo even existed. He didn't even know what it was, and he couldn't care about it. However, he was really interested in telling me about his adventures. Linda probably had another thing, you know, about walking to school and her overshoes got full of water or something. Who knows? So I made a decision, and I made an announcement. Okay, when I come home from a trip or anything like this, until the kids go to bed, I don't want to even hear any questions. But if you guys want to know everything that went on, I'll stay up till 2 in the morning if necessary to tell you. Now, I think that was a good decision, because I think that's what we need to do with our families. And by the way, running a navigator home, I don't think is the place to raise a family. That's not the easiest place in all the world to do it. Too much competition. I'm glad that we got out of it eventually. But, you know, there you can probably survive, and there are ways. But I think one of the things is you better give the family the attention they need all the way along. Recently, I overheard a businessman who had become a Christian discussing with another guy about how things had changed in his family. And he was a businessman who had just driven himself with everything he had to be successful in business, to make money, to provide houses, lands, family, cars, boats, everything for his family. He was doing all this for his family, he realized. He became a Christian and took a different kind of an interest in his family. He went to the soccer game that his kid was playing. Now, it wasn't too interesting, you know. Beginning soccer isn't exactly the thing to watch. And he said, you know, I just kind of stood around. It was kind of like a waste of time. He said, I had no idea what that meant to him, because he expressed it later. And I thought, boy, it's time to learn that. You know, sophomore basketball games are not fun to watch. They're klutzes. But I'd suggest you go if they're in it, because you're developing an image for them. Recently, I heard a converted Mooney giving his testimony. It's a fascinating testimony. And he told that he's 16. His dad didn't care much about him. He came by once in a while in his taxi in New York and visited him. He said I lived there where he lived, but he had to make a trip to see me. And he said, at 16, he kicked me out of the house. He said, where does the 16-year-old go? And he said, I went over and lived with this homosexual that I knew, who had was halfway interested in me, traded favors with him so that I could stay there. He said, then entered my life some Moonies who showed me that I was important, that somebody cared about my existence on this earth. And that's what converted him to Mooneyism, or whatever you want to call it. I thought, okay, there's a guy that had no image of himself at all, and why was it? Because his parents didn't care what he was. And where'd he end up? Where you'd expect him to end up. Now, fortunately, he became a Christian. I was with my son had an English teacher this last year, was what I'll call the over-enthusiastic type. And boy, she was going to do everything, you know, having setting goals and all this sort of thing. You know, I mean, it was just a big deal. And I think she'd read 10 books on positive thinking and thrown that in the English class. So I went over to visit with her. And I was kind of braced anyway, because there's some of this stuff I call garbage. And one of the things that they were going to have to do is, you know, a big project on who I am, or who am I? You know, answer that question. So I sat there and I said, lady, I think that's a dumb question. And I said, you could ask that question to me, and depending on the day and the weather, I could give a different answer every time. You ask me one day, I'd tell him I'm an entrepreneur. You ask me another day, I'd tell you I'm a preacher. You ask me another day, and I'm a contractor. You ask me another day, it depends on who I'm talking to, who I am. And I said, I just think you're asking a ridiculous question for kids this age to fool around with. Well, she made a statement to me. She said, you are a very unusual parent. Of course, I think she was trying to ace me out or something. But she went on to say, she said, you don't know, Mr. Marshall, how little interest people have in what's going on with their kids in school. Most of the kids in my class, their parents won't even show up here to talk to me. They couldn't care. And I thought, okay, why do we have so much problem with the self-image? It's because parents don't pay any attention to their kids. They ignore them. And that's the way they feel. Now, what do you do about that? Well, I think you give them attention. You play with them when they're little. You do go to the events they're in. You make a big deal out of the successes they have. And you build that. They believe in themselves. Okay? Second thing that we're all interested in, I'm sure, is the other side of this coin, I suppose. It's called discipline. How do you go about doing that? I'm going to put /control here, because I think we think discipline and control in the same ballgame. And I suppose they fit. Now, I think that there are several kinds of control or discipline that we're going to be dealing with during the life of a child. The unfortunate thing is, I think most of us have only one concept of it. The first one, and that's this one. The first one that we will probably be involved with is control by force. Now, this can be force physically, or it can be force reasoning-wise. Probably it's the physical kind. Now, I think that we should aim all discipline at the purpose or result that we're after. It should have a reason, not just because I'm ticked off about the fixtures on the ceiling shaking because they're horsing around upstairs, but there's got to be some reason. Now, I think some of us have, many of us have gone through military experiences, whether it be the Marine Corps or any other, and the training that's executed there is a non-reasoning, do what you're told, discipline. It's all physical. Mind over matter. You don't matter and they don't mind. Now, discipline by force, I think, has two purposes. One is safety. I can't let Lisa, two, out in the front yard, go charging off across the street. So when she reaches the curb, I've got to do something about that. And it isn't going to do any good to say, Lisa, don't run in the street. You go over there and say, no! And, you know, execute a little pain, maybe, if she can't figure out after being told once or twice. You've got to do that. He'll kill himself. Self-destruct. Now, I think there's another one that comes in this same group, and that is sanity, I'll put down here. You all understand what I mean by that. Like I said, when the fixtures are shaking on the ceiling, it's because something is happening above it. And maybe, for sanity's sake, we need to control that somehow. I think another way to say that is just order. And God was concerned about that. In fact, very concerned about it to the point that if a parent could not manage to control the child, there was another alternative. And one that you would never think about doing. It's in Deuteronomy chapter, 21. It's a paragraph there, three verses. It says, if you've got a son that's rebellious and you can't get him under control, then you go down, you and your wife take that son down to the elders at the gate and tell them, this son is rebellious and stubborn and we can't control him, and they will stone him to death. Now, somehow I think God had order in mind. Now, I'm not suggesting that you stone your child, see. And I'm not even suggesting you beat on him very hard. I think there's some other ways to handle this. But the fact simply is there is a reason for discipline of this kind. And that is to maintain order and control and some kind of sanity around you. Now, the unfortunate thing is we can make a big mistake. We can major on this kind of discipline and make that the whole ball game till we reach this last stage of development. You see, if we try to maintain this pain and pleasure approach of discipline all the way out to here, where independence sets in, what do you think is going to happen? Rebellion? You betcha. One of two things will happen. Either they'll just become a nothing, ying, 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 let you go ahead and do that, or they will tell you, why don't you hang it on your left ear and be gone? And you'll probably never relate to them satisfactorily the rest of your life. Because they're going to be independent, whether you like it or not. And that kind of discipline will get you there if you don't do something else. So let's talk about the next kind. Let's call this control, a different kind. Control by reason. A few years ago, when I was still a navigator, I had the opportunity to do some evaluating of our training. And we had a lot of training programs around the country. Then these college kids would go to Maranatha Bible Camp or somewhere, you know, and have a training program. And the concept that we were dealing with, unfortunately, was kind of the military approach to training. I hope they've changed since then. I hammered on their heads long enough that they should have, but, you know, we sometimes have a hard time changing. And I interviewed a guy here at Glen Eyrie about the program. This is how I was doing this. And I said, what'd you learn at Maranatha? I said, I learned not to slam doors. I said, what? Yeah, learn how to slam doors. Tell me about that. Well, boy, he says, I went flying through a door one day, and it went kabang, and the guy says, give me 10. He said, 10 what? He said, 10 push-ups. I went down, you know, push 10 push-ups. That's Marine Corps, you see. And he said, man, I learned not to slam any doors. Well, I said, that's interesting. When you got here, have you learned anything since you got to Glen Eyrie? Oh, yeah, I learned how to slam doors. I said, what's that? Well, he says, I'm working down here in the kitchen. Man, he says, this guy went flying through the door one day, and the door went bang. You know, he's carrying a hot pan of stuff. And he said, give me 10. He said, 10 what? 10 push-ups to go fly. So he says, I let the door slam here. Now, you say, what did you all learn from that? Well, I'll tell you what I think. He learned nothing at Maranatha and a whole lot less here. He still doesn't know what the principle is. You know, at Maranatha, the principle was, don't slam the door. There may be a lady in the next room who has a baby sleeping, and she'll have a headache all day long if you don't quit slamming doors so they wake them up. I know about that. See, but there's a reason for not slamming doors in a society where there's a lot, you could disturb a lot of people. Now, we were trying to deal with that training situation by this approach instead of this one. And what's the reason behind it? Now, this guy was intelligent enough to figure that out if you just tell him. But we hadn't figured out that that's what we ought to be doing. With children, it's the same thing. Now, what part of this program are we going to get into this reasoning process? Well, it's in this phase two. Sometime after they reach 3.5, 4, and so on, you can find you actually sit down and talk to them, and they come to some conclusions. So, we're going to do some reasoning with them here and talk to them. Now, that particular phase of development, I'm going to call this, where we're reasoning and developing, where we're really getting into developing the person so that they can think. It just occurred to me that Solomon wrote the Proverbs to give a young man who was approaching adulthood some capacity to face life. And he said, whatever you do, get wisdom. And he said, the whole purpose in writing this is to write this to you, my son, so that you get knowledge and wisdom. In fact, let's turn there just to the first couple chapters of Proverbs, and I'll throw a couple things at you that this will do for you, which is, I'm sure, something we'd want all our kids to be able to get in on. Actually, let's pick up in chapter 2. Let's go down to verse 5 here. Let's read verse 2 and or verse 1, and then I'll kind of skip along here. We'd have to read the whole chapter. Verse 1 says, my son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments with you, making ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your hearts to understanding, yes, if you cry out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it like silver and search for it as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. And of course, that's one thing we'd like to have them get to. Verse 9, then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity and every good path. Verse 11, discretion will watch over you, understanding will guard you. Verse 12, delivering you from the evil way and from men of perverted speech. Down here at verse 20, so you will walk in the way of good men and keep the path of righteousness. And chapter 3, he gets on to the same thing. Verse 2, for length of days and years, an abundant welfare will they give you. See, what we're really after, down at the end, when we turn these kids out to pasture or whatever it is that they'd be able to do those things, right? Okay, during those formative years, from 4 to 14 or wherever it is, that's what you're doing, is giving them a foundation of wisdom, understanding, knowledge, and all those kinds of things. And this is why it's a reasoning process. And take the time for that to happen. Now, while we're talking about that, how do you go about teaching these things to people? You know, Proverbs says, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. How do we do that? Well, most of us take the kids to Sunday school and dump them off, or, well, we probably go to Sunday school ourselves, but we, you know, rely on the Sunday school to teach them all this stuff. Well, that's partially helpful, but not really going to get the job done. You know where they're going to learn the most? At home. Now, so, well, what do I do? Get an instruction class going? Well, you can do that if you want to, but I suggest something even better than that. Get a living class going. Your kids are going to do what you do, not what you say. And so are mine. And if you want to see what your kids are going to do when they're 20 or 25, look in a mirror. You know, observe what you do and how you behave. They're going to do exactly the same. They're just like one big giant camera taking pictures all the time. They expose everything you are. And the instruction in Deuteronomy chapter 6 is this. You shall talk of the Lord when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. What I think he's saying there is the way that you teach is to relate the principles of the Word of God as you see them in your life to every event that goes on in every situation that you live in with them. We came to some conclusions about this. I was doing a study trying to get a new church idea started, and I read in a book by Larry Richards about a group of people that started a church up somewhere in Wisconsin, and I was surprised at something. They concluded that they didn't want a Sunday school, that it was a negative thing to have. And, hey, that's an interesting thought. So I pursued this thought reading it. They concluded this, that it is the responsibility of parents to spiritually instruct children, not a Sunday school. And the Sunday school is merely a cop-out. And the thing that they majored on is making disciples and Christian livers out of the parents, and said that'll get across to the kid. I said, boy, they're right on. And later on, we were having a discussion with our family in this old church situation, and we were talking about the concept we have of God, and I asked the kids what their concept was, and they kind of went around and told us. And I was a little unhappy with the result, because one of them says, I think he's a big policeman in the sky. And another one, he goes around clobbering you when you're wrong. And I said, how'd you get that idea? Well, unfortunately, part of it came from me, which I didn't like. But we analyzed for a long time, and we came to a conclusion. One of the reasons that they thought this is that they had been bombarded constantly by Sunday school stories. Now, most Sunday school lessons for kids come from where? The Old Testament. What kind of stories are they? David and Goliath. Good guy wins, bad guy gets a rock in his head, right? I mean, we could turn on the television and watch Gunsmoke and come up with the same conclusion, right? Did we get across the idea in that story that the reason David went out there is because he trusted God? It was really faith that was that story. But the kids got the rock in the head. And I realized something. Hey, if you just analyze all the stories as they go through, hey, Sunday school stories don't do it. It's the living situation we're in that does. So if you want them to turn out a certain way, live that way. Now, I think the last stage in this program of control, if I can find the right sheet now, the last one is self-control. When the day comes for them to walk out your door, whatever it may be the cause, hopefully we all do this, they do this with a smile on their face and a tear in their eye or whatever. We want them to be at this point where they are capable of self-control. Now, there's two kinds of relationships that we have with all people. One of them is dependent. Now, just analyze this as an adult. Do you like this relationship with anybody? You like to be in a position to be dependent on anybody else? Really? Not really, do you? You like to be independent. You don't want somebody making the decisions for you. So, the next relationship that we can have is independent. And quite frankly, we all like that one. Because we'd like to be able to decide what we're going to do, think what we want to think, be what we want to be, act like we want to act. Now, if you'll just take those two relationships and look at the life of a child, when the child arrives in your home, there's no question about it. They are absolutely 100% totally dependent on you for everything. But from about day two on, that begins to change. And the ultimate end of this is right here. They're going to be independent. So I think what we're doing is raising children is we are preparing them for the day that they are independent of us and have self-control and are capable of living a life of righteousness, justice, mercy, peace, goodness. That's what we want to see. I think a mistake we make is that we keep them dependent so long that when they get to that place, they can't operate independent. Or their independence is such an act of violence that it's hard to deal with, and they don't know what to do with it. See, what down here in this independence, we have decision-making. The child has to be able to do that. We have trust. I have to trust him to make one. He has to have established values by which to make those kinds of decisions. And if those aren't there, what kind of decisions are going to be made? So our job is to develop those values and to teach and to instruct and to live so that when they get to that point where they want to operate independently, they are capable of it and they're going to operate in an independent fashion that will praise God. Okay? I sure am long-winded. I used all the time I could. But I've got 2 minutes according to that clock. Are there any burning questions that just you can't get out of here without asking? I won't say I've got an answer. I'll just let you ask it.
As far as I agree fully with what you said about they want to be what you are and not necessarily what you say. And since that's the way they're going to learn anyway, what is the value of having the family devotion?
Well, you have a good question there. Would it surprise you if I told you that we don't have family devotions? Or we don't? Now, I'm one of those terrible heretics, I'm sure. But I probably don't because my parents became Christians at about the same time I did. And I was 8 and they were, 30-some. And they had family devotions. They didn't force me to be in on them. But I ultimately made a decision of my own, and that is it would be a good idea to read the Word of God on a daily basis. And I'm sure that one of the influencing factors is the fact that they were doing that. And I'm really in a dilemma here on how to answer your question because I don't want to knock family altars or getting together with your family and reading. In fact, I think that's a good idea from age 0 on. You know, if you're going to read after breakfast or whatever, just go ahead and do it. I think you can't hurt anything gaining information, you know, and discussing it. Now, quite frankly, one of the most meaningful experiences that we're having right at this period of time and have had for the last 3 or 4 years is that we have been in a kind of a little dinky church situation where our family is the basic biggest part of the unit, and we have a Bible study discussion type of thing going on. Now, interesting thing, now that I'm sure this is more meaningful to teenagers than it is to little ones, but our teenagers are frankly saying, hey, we don't want to go back to a church where you sit and listen to the guy preach. We don't learn anything that way. And I have been very impressed with some of the profound things that those kids say when they make responses. So to answer your question, what value would it be? I think if that became the approach to family altar, where there was a discussion going on how do we do this, how do we apply this to our lives, etc., I can't think of a better thing to have happening. Now, you got to be prepared for some feedback. They might tell you once in a while as you're following up, like mine did. I probably so blew your mind on that one that you won't even ask any more questions. Now, there are times I'd have to say I don't feel comfortable about the fact that I have not, you know, gone through that exercise of reading the Bible daily together with family, thinking that, you know, everybody else is doing it, I'm failing. But the results that we're getting at this point, I'm not worried, fortunately. However you say that. Yes.
Okay, with your boys, when they got to be teenagers, they just kind of knew that you thought it'd be nice if they read the Bible every day on their own, or did you do something to make sure?
Mine?
Or do they?
Well, I don't think they read on a daily basis. They're quite lazy in that regard, fairly human. But some things are happening. Well, I think Linda's the oldest. She came to the conclusion to really get into that Bible on her own. I'm not sure how she arrived at that. Was it just being at school where all the heathen were? I don't know. Probably the one that registers the most with me right now is Dan. He's a senior in high school, and just about it was only a matter of weeks ago that we were sitting together talking, and he was commenting about the fact that, boy, you got such a knowledge of the Bible. He's talking about me. You can bring up a topic and you can grab something and throw it on it, you know. And so I said, well, I didn't get that way instantaneously. I said, I started reading the Bible every day when I was about your age. And, I started picking up those answers, and after a while, read it through three or four times, you get to the place where you can do that. Well, now that started a new program for him. In fact, he's preaching to the other boys now. Man, I'm reading through Matthew. Man, did I learn a lot. And I was sharing that with this guy over here that's his buddy. I said, hey, that's all right. I like that. Now, I guess the reason why I am more in favor of that than the open the can and shove it down their mouth routine is that when he gets to the place where he makes that decision, I know what's going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. We just have to sit there and listen. It could be two things. One good, one bad. And I guess more part of it is because my dad was so liberal with me. My dad showed me a great deal of trust from the very beginning. In fact, if I learned anything about trusting kids, in fact, my sister, we were in a ski vacation. She made a statement a few years ago. I don't think I'll ever be as liberal with my kids as Dad was with us. And I didn't even understand what she was saying at first. I thought, now let's see, Dad was liberal? But what she meant was that he let her make the decisions of what she was going to do. And he let me make the decisions of what I was going to do. I can remember coming to him for counsel on something to do in high school, and he said, well, if you think the Spirit of God's leading you to do that, do it. And if you think he isn't, don't. And that was the end of the counsel. Big hell. You know, now I'm at the desperation of finding the will of God for myself. You know. But I think, hey, he had the right idea. And that's what I hope is happening in my family. Yeah.
Well, I don't know the answer to it either. I didn't do much to help them with that. Now, I am now. I tell them, hey, if you're going to read the Bible, probably Genesis is not the place to start. You know, let's start someplace where it's going to be interesting, and then we'll, you know, we'll get the rest of that later. No, now we did read, Kay read an awful lot of Bible stories with the kids, which I think was the beginning. Of course, again, you have to say that I've been around Christian, you know, doing, I was in full-time Christian work for a number of years. By the way, I thought that would have a profound effect upon the kids, but it didn't. They can't even remember that. So they were too young to really get a big impact off that. I think the biggest impact has come, you know, later on, where they were beginning to register what makes me tick the way I do. I hope that's what it is. Yeah. I think with me, I feel this way. Go ahead and suggest that it's a good idea to read. But there's nothing more dull and deadening to devotions to say, me have to, that I can think of, for me to tell my kids, sit down and read that chapter. I don't think I'm going to help them there. So I kind of throw the bait out every now and then. You know, they take it, I do everything I can to help them when they grab the bait. But until then, I don't try to force it. Now, Doug, last year, as a matter of fact, on the notes that I had here last year, it said, Doug, TMS. Now, he got excited about memorizing some scripture. I think his sister did that. Linda was home preaching about what scripture memory had done for her. He thought he ought to get started on that. So I had a note here, buy him a TMS while I was out here. Now, I don't think he's memorized more than two or three, but, you know, it was a starter. So we tried. I guess it's part of it is that I feel that I've seen Christians who had stuff crammed down their throat and they really didn't turn out too good. Maybe it's because I'm involved with a Christian college in Minneapolis. And quite frankly, the product of Christianity that was being produced there, I wouldn't trade a nickel's worth of it for what I got at the university where all the heathen were. And when a guy got converted there and started walking with God, there's something new and different about it. And somehow, with the Christian school, this is so old and so moldy and like the mold on the rocks out here that, you know, they weren't excited about it. And I think Dr. Hendricks made this statement to us at a one-year staff conference. He said, there's a problem with second-generation Christianity. First-generation Christianity, this is a person that's 30 years old or so, and he gets encountered with Jesus Christ, and he becomes a Christian, and he's just a ball of fire. Man, is this great! Then his child comes along, and he beats it into him from age 4 or 3 or wherever. As a matter of fact, you know, our daughter became a Christian, or, you know, prayed when she was 4 years old. When she was 10, she came to Kay and said, would you tell me again what it was I did when I was 4? And I think, let's see, we're so doggone anxious to get her converted, you know, we're going to have her pray, you know, like a parrot. And I don't know for sure that she became a Christian when she was 4, now that I look back on it. And I'm not going to say whether she did or she didn't. But I think that we're into the point where in that second generation, we've got to give them a chance to make that decision for Jesus Christ. And make the decision to follow him. And I know it's one of the hardest things on earth for us to sit back and wait for them to decide some of that stuff. But I think if they decide it, that second generation Christian is going to be a better one than he was if we just shoved it down his throat and then he had to try to recover from it. Yep. Yep. I think it's by the way you live and by the things you talk about. See, Deuteronomy doesn't say have family devotions. It says talk of the Lord when you sit in your house, walk around, rise up, do this. Okay, if I make a business deal and I think God really blessed that, I tell the kids, God blessed me. Now that's worth more than 10 chapters of Deuteronomy at 8 o'clock in the morning. I think. I think that's, I'm not saying be void of instruction. I think what I'm saying is do it in the context of life where you're impacted by it and they know it. Yeah.
Instruction doesn't necessarily have to be a formal classroom.
Right. Yes. Thank you. Yeah, and that's every day when you're raising kids. All day, every day. Yes. Boy, you're going to have to eat lunch. If you want to keep on, go ahead. The rest you want to leave, fine. I don't eat. That would be the nature of it, yeah. I probably would. That's not my style to get involved about the ambulance going down the street with a stranger in it, but yeah, you're on the right track, yes. That's the kind of thing I would deal with.
How did you guys get to the point that you were real sensitive to every situation, not everybody?
Oh, I don't think we were. I mean, I can't really say with all honesty. I've missed so many opportunities that I knew later that God had laid in my lap, like we all do. Do you witness at every opportunity you get? No. Do you kick yourself when you realize you should have? Yes. And that's kind of the way it is with raising kids, but the same thing is true. If you're conscious of it, you're going to hit a few of them at least. That's the best I can do for you, right?
Yeah, I was thinking, I teach school and I've been teaching for many years, and the way children are stifled at school, how they have that, you know, the blind to seek and everything before they come to the public schools. Boy, by the time they get out, there's a regiment and everything else that they're, forget them, man, I'll look at another book. And I see your point of view this way.
Well, thank you. I'm encouraged a little bit.
I agree with that too. But might I say that until they say, hey, why should I have to go to Sunday school? Why not have it? Like you say, they are interested.
Yeah.
They are interested when they're younger and they want to learn all this and they learn all the books of the Bible and they can't find them. They know the scriptures and things. The seeds will come out later.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and it isn't that I'd hate to get to that point. You know, I'd rather have it get to the point, why are we doing this, or whatever, and then explain it. Yeah. Yeah. I think you ought to have a workshop and let you run it on how to have family devotions. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, some people are into that and I'm not. I'm so uncreative, I guess I can't figure that out. Yeah. So, that's a good point. I mean, and they should enjoy it. It should be a good experience. Yeah, I can. I have since concluded that our family is a strange bunch. So, you know, just... Yeah. Because when I tell them what my kids are reacting, other people say, hey, yours is different. But the first thing is, David was in high school at the time that we left the big establishment, and he was into a Sunday school class where all his friends were and a youth group and all that sort of thing. And I thought, man, this is not the right thing to do because he's going to pull him out of this peer thing that is so important to people his age. So what we did is we said, all right, Dave, we're going to do this, but we're going to arrange the schedule on church so that you can still go to your Sunday school class and youth meetings and that sort of thing and continue that if that's what you want to do. It's up to you. Okay, we did that, and he continued with that for what, Case? Oh, she's too busy talking. 6 months, I think. But slowly he kind of dropped off of doing that, pretty soon not at all. Well, we got to a point in that first round. We've been through 3 rounds now trying to do this, none of them working. But anyway, we went through that round and we had a meeting set to get together to discuss. What shall we do? Shall we keep going? Shall we just punt this thing and go back to another, you know, pick a church and do it? Or what are we going to do from here?
Well, Dave doesn't like meetings, so he says, by the way, Dad, you don't need to invite me to that meeting. Fine. So, no, this was going to be with the other couples that were involved in it. We're going to have dinner and all that, you know. That's anathema to him. But I really was concerned because I want to know how they felt. So we were standing in the kitchen a few minutes before going to this meeting, and I said, hey, you guys, I need to know what you want to do. You know, here are the options. We can go back, sit in a church and listen to a guy preach, go to Sunday school, do the youth meetings and that sort of thing. And I told him my concern about the youth thing, that they probably ought to have friends that are involved in the same things, etc. And the reaction universally was, we don't want to go back to that. We are learning too much by getting the opportunity to participate in the discussion. I said, thank you very much. And I realized, hey, you know, and the other thing that concerned me is that here's kids sitting in an adult discussion most of the time. And their contribution was once every, you know, maybe one kid once a week would say something. The rest of the time they sit there like bumps on the sofa. You think, I don't think they're getting anything. And then they come off with that reaction, and I realize, hey, you know, we got to get alert to the fact that they're learning tons by listening to us discuss. You know, and of course, most of the discussion was, how do you apply this to real life? So, yeah, Dwayne? Yes. Right, and I kicked back on that to my own childhood. I, of course, grew up with adults being in a farm situation. You don't have a chance to be with very many kids your age. There's no opportunity. They live too far away. And church was, we had a few, very few that were my age. But the big things that I remember about, that I really enjoyed, okay, we'd be invited over to another couple's home. They didn't have any kids my age at all. And there'd be a missionary invited in that had spoken at church. And they'd sit there and eat cake, drink coffee, and I'd sit there and listen to their discussion. I think I learned tons in that situation, and I think I really enjoyed it, even though I don't think I participated much. So I think we're missing something by not realizing what they're picking up. You know, silence does not mean ignorance, or however that is. Okay? Well, I'm here as long as you are, but, yeah.
Last year you made a statement about your kids doing something they wanted to witness. Some high school students, you know, some of your kids in high school,
yeah,
wanted to share. And I just, you know, are you familiar with Ed Rice?
I know Ed, yeah.
Well, anyway, I've been chatting with him, like, and I'm very turned on and involved into being a non-Christian world, like, not secluded.
I'm with you. Amen. Preach it.
And I kind of picked up last year that that's what your kids were trying to do.
Yeah, I'll give you the example. I didn't tell it this time because I forgot to, but David, in this same scene that we had in the living room that I was telling you about, said that, and it's a kind of a little negative about one person he knows, but this guy happened to be involved in Bible studies and all this sort of thing, which most of us think is a great deal, but then in the same class. And he said, well, he said, I tell you what, he said, I've observed two things. There's two kids. One is Don, this friend of his. And he said, he is into Bible studies, and that's the only thing he ever does. And the rest of the kids look at him and say, what a drag. But he said, there's another girl who's a Christian. She goes to all the parties every Friday night and brings her six-pack of Mountain Dew. Now, when it gets so drunk in there, you know, everybody's so bombed out of their gourd that there's no longer any point in being there, she leaves. But he says, I think she's a better testimony than the guy that goes to Bible study all the time. He says, that's what I think I ought to be doing. I ought to be in contact with these people. How are they going to see Christianity if I'm not there? I said, you're right. Now, it's interesting. The impact that, now, if you want to, you know, look at it. He's been working on this one friend of his for years. We took him skiing. They disappeared and they were downstairs for a couple hours outside sitting there, and he's preaching to him. He goes to that guy's house. He tries to drag him out to church. He preaches to him some more. His girlfriend has become a Christian. His girlfriend's sister has become a Christian about Easter time as a consequence of these people. Him and his girlfriend impacting him. I think, hey, they're on target. Which is exciting for me. You know, I had to have somebody twist my arm and push me out the door to do that.
So I think there is a positive side to this thing, to let it happen. And now the other son, who's a senior in high school, Dave and Dan were working together with this neighbor kid, working for a guy putting in sprinklers. Man, they stayed up one night till about 10 o'clock standing out in the driveway preaching to this guy. And right, man, they come to church, we got to pray for Wolf. Wolf needs Christ. Wolf says that if he reads this that we've told him to read, he knows he's going to change, but he doesn't want to. He's afraid of what will happen. Well, I kind of get encouraged when that's happening. And those are the kinds of results that make you really happy as a parent. And then you look back and say, did I do anything to make that happen? I don't know whether I did or not. You know? I didn't preach evangelism to him, I know that. Or I think I didn't. Any more questions? Well, lunch is out there wherever it is, and you're free to go.